And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State versus Galvin. Mr. Piccolo, good morning to you.
Good morning, members of the court, Mr. Chief Justice. As I just mentioned, I'm Gerard Piccolo, representing the appellant, Braden Galvin. There are two cases actually, and they present issues concerning credit for time served prior to sentencing, as well as the consecutive nature of sentencing, or the sentences in each of the cases. I would note this deals with post-release supervision, which is a very special statute. If I may, I'd like to just go over some time or some dates for you. Mr. Galvin was sentenced on June 19th of last year, and his post-release supervision was revoked on April 16th of last year, and this was at a hearing where Mr. Galvin admitted to, I believe, a violation of the motion to revoke post-release supervision. Judge Livingston at that time revoked Mr. Galvin's bond and also revoked his post-release supervision.
Now, that was in both cases?
That's correct, John.
Was he serving post-release supervision in both cases simultaneously?
Yes, the terms of post-release supervision in each of the cases end on October 12th and of 2019.
The original sentences were ordered to be conserved consecutively.
Yes, but the way the record looks, the post-release supervision started in each particular case on the same day and ended on the same day.
Did the imprisonment run consecutively, or did that run concurrently as well? I mean, there's nothing in our record that we can tell. Is that right?
As to the original sentence, Your Honor, is that what you're referring to?
The imprisonment of the original sentence.
I am not 100% sure. I did the original trial, but I don't remember off the top of my head. I do know in this particular case, all of the motions to revoke post-release supervision say that post-release supervision in each case ended on October 12th.
Started on October.
Well, it ended on October 12, 2019, and started 1 year before that.
It commenced on October 10, 2018. Is that correct?
Something like that, yes.
Okay. So whether the original sentence said there would be consecutive, that doesn't appear to have happened. They appear to be running the same time.
Yeah, I would say there's nothing in the record there where you can derive something like that, and I actually don't remember, to be honest with you.
Well, what does the law require?
Well, the law requires that, and that's my second issue, actually. The law requires...
With respect to the consecutive sentences.
In that particular case, the law requires, as the statute says, that the remaining term of post-release supervision is the limit that the sentencing court on a motion to revoke post-release can sentence a person to.
That's what it said at one point in time, but that's not what it says now.
No, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
I'm getting to that. At the time of the sentencing, that's what it said.
And wasn't the second charge or conviction assault by a confined person? And doesn't that require it to be run consecutive to any other sentence?
Your Honor, I'll defer to the record. Again, I don't remember specifically what the original charges were. It might be. It would seem to make sense.
The record is. That's what's in the record.
Yeah, it would seem to make sense. I don't have any reason to disregard or disbelieve what you're telling me. I just don't remember off the top of my head. Again, as I mentioned before, all the information that we have from this record, post-release started on the same day, ended on the same day in both of the cases.
What do we do if we conclude that the terms of post-release supervision should have run consecutively, but the record seems to show that everybody acted as if they were being served concurrently? Is that something we can correct now?
I'm going to say the answer to that is no. Because I think as a practical matter, you're limited to this record. That might be a little bit of a stretch. There's nothing in this record to say that the post... again, I'm deferring to the record. If there's something there, that's fine. But again, I'm deferring to the record. There's nothing that says that these... the original sentences were consecutive to each other.
If the record shows some facts and the application of the sentencing statute means as applied to these facts, it must have been consecutive, error or not, would that not be a plain error? In other words, it would be an unauthorized sentence to make them concurrent. Would we not note that?
I would tell you there's nothing in the post-release statute which says that.
But that's an answer to a different question. My question would be, if an application of the law to the facts that are undisputed would indicate an unauthorized sentence, then where are we?
That's a very good question. I don't know whether I can answer that. I think you'd have to send it back. I really don't know. I don't know how to answer
it. I think it's fundamental to our analysis, isn't it?
Well, it can be. If you're telling me that these post-release supervision sentences should have been consecutive to each other because the original was...
By operation of law, and then perhaps there was an unauthorized sentence.
Right. Again, I would have to say, on this record, I don't think there's anything to support that.
Okay.
It was clear Mr. Galvin understood that his post-release supervision ran at the same time in both of the cases.
Okay. I beg your pardon. I interrupted Justice.
No, you're good. Thank you.
In the absence of a statute that says a particular crime sentence has to be consecutive, the scheme for post-release supervision is that prison sentences are served first, and if they are consecutive, they're one after the other, and then and only then does post-release supervision begin. Is that your understanding?
I think you can interpret the statutes that way, Your Honor, yes.
So isn't the real question then, what's the effect of this other statute that's separate and pre-existing of the post-conviction statutes when it says that notwithstanding any other provision, the sentence has to be consecutive? Does that apply to post-release supervision?
And I would say no. And here's my analysis for you, and I was going to refer to that. If there is some ambiguity in the statutes, especially penal statutes, Mr. Galvin gets the benefit of the ambiguity. I think the statutes are unclear with regard to the consecutive nature, as you just mentioned, consecutive being post-release has to be consecutive. Furthermore, it seems a little contrary to the post-release statute if, for instance, you have two consecutive sentences. The first sentence, the post-release supervision, would start while the second sentence is being served. So you would have a person on post-release supervision that's in jail. So I think they have to be run at the same time afterwards. Again, there's ambiguity there. I don't doubt that. I don't question that from what you're telling me.
If before your time runs out, there's another aspect of this that I want to get to, and that's in essence your argument for application of the Randolph Doctrine.
Correct.
And my problem with your analysis is you want us to apply Randolph, but only to part of the change. You want to pick out the part of the change that says you get jail credit, but you don't want us to apply the change that says instead of remaining, it's the original imprisonment. So can one apply the Randolph Doctrine in a pick and choose perspective? Don't you have to take the whole statute as it's changed?
I'm going to answer that by saying I think you can, if it's beneficial to the client or beneficial to the defendant, I think the Randolph Doctrine applies. If it's not, then it doesn't apply. I mean, I'm just applying the Randolph Doctrine as I know it.
If you apply that whole statutory change, however, it may not make any difference at all. If you take the original time instead of the remaining and give jail credit, you may end up exactly where it would have been under the old statute. And then, does the Randolph Doctrine apply at all?
It need not.
Okay.
It need not. It can apply, but it need not. I think what you're referring to is if he gets credit for the 64 days, then you were really close up against the limit of the statute, the remaining portion or remaining period of post-release supervision. I think that's what you're saying.
I'm talking more about math than I am about
okay.
it. All right. Thank you.
Okay. I will like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if the Chief Justice will allow me to do that. Thank you.
You may. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Justice Castle, I will respond to your question first because I have a different take on that particular issue. The amended statute 29-2268 actually increased the penalty for violations of supervised release. So it's my position that it cannot be applied retroactively without violating ex post facto. But with respect to the Randolph doctrine, I don't think it applies anyway, because both supervised release terms were part of his original sentence, which became final nearly 2 years ago. And so I think the operative provision or the statute that governs here would be the statute that was in effect at the time that he was sentenced, not the statute that was amended long after his sentences became final.
And that's because there was no direct appeal from the sentence, and that's the finality that accrued then.
That's correct. And my understanding of Randolph is if you don't have a final judgment, commits the offense and is tried and convicted and that sort of thing, the amendment occurs before it becomes final, while the case is on direct appeal, then he gets the benefit of that change. My problem with that here is that supervised release is really part of the original sentence, and I think that once that sentence becomes final, as this one has, we're basically stuck with those statutory or the substantive provisions that were in effect at the time that he was sentenced and his became final. So I don't think it has any application here at all.
Have you done the math to see what difference it would make if you were to compare the methodology from Judge Funk's case that was pre the amendment compared to the post-amendment version?
Actually, I did not do the math, okay. But I would assume that it would be a substantially longer period of time, since what we were essentially dealing with here. At the time that he was revoked on April 16th, he had a little bit more than 8 months left. Now, the calculation that I did in my brief basically gave him credit for the 2 months that he sat in there, and then I took the date from the date of sentencing out to the end of what his term of supervised release would have been plus the 70 days of absconsion. So I think we're both dealing with the same fixed period. The dispute here, it lies in, he's saying, well, I was revoked on April 16th. I served those 2 months. So when the court imposed my sentence in June, it gave me 5 months, it had to give me credit for those 2 months toward the 5 months it imposed. My position is, well, what happened was the court gave you credit for those 2 months, and then it imposed a sentence based on the time remaining as of the date he was sentenced. So we're both dealing with the same fixed term, the same end date. It's just what, do you use April 16th or do you use June 19th, which is the date that he was sentenced? And I think therein lies the rub in this case when it comes to, because this case differs from Phillips a little bit in the sense that in Phillips, he was detained prior to the time that he was revoked and sentenced, because that happened on the same day. In this case, he was revoked 2 months before he was actually sentenced, and he was remanded to custody for that 2 months. And so now the question becomes, well, what do we do? You know, in Phillips, the court treated that 98 days that he, you know, prior to revocation as being served on his supervised release, even though he was technically incarcerated. And so that was kind of the analysis that I followed when I was writing my brief, was, well, I'll give him credit for that. You know, like I said, the rub here is that he was actually revoked during the 2 months. And so it's like, well, now does you give him credit toward that sentence, and what do we do with it? Because here, it's like, I think technically my position would be that if the court, that the court essentially, it may have given him credit on the wrong portion of his sentence, but it nevertheless gave him credit, and he's not entitled to any further relief. If the court disagrees, though, and determines that the court was obligated to apply those 2 months of credit to the sentence that was actually imposed, and I suppose the court could just modify the sentence as it does in every other case.
I beg your pardon, so is it critical to your analysis that his status following April is he's got a revoked status?
Yes.
That's where he is in the choices, that the halo that follows him, right? He's not post-release. He's a revoked defendant.
Exactly.
He's not a sentenced defendant.
No, but he has technically been revoked, and so
right.
I think that should probably, in fairness, affect the amount of time remaining on, you know, I mean, well,
he's
I mean,
a revoked, he's a revoked defendant at that point. For
yeah,
those couple
he's
months.
Revoked, and it's just like, for to me, it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other, because if you give him, if you determine the time remaining becomes fixed at the point that he's revoked, because technically he's revoked. Now we're looking at the rest.
That's
that
his
he
status.
Has there. Exactly.
Okay.
But when you get to the sentencing phase, and in this case we don't know because we didn't have the same discussion that we had between the court and counsel and Phillips, where they were, you know, where defense counsel came up and argued, hey, he should get credit for this time, and they had that discussion. The court's like, well, I'm just not going to count that. We're going to go from this date forward. I don't have that here. So I don't know exactly what was thinking. I can only infer from the length of the sentence imposed and the fact that the court didn't specifically give him credit that he went from the date of sentencing, kind of following the Phillips analysis and maybe not making that distinction between, well, he's technically been revoked as opposed to I revoked him and sentenced him on the same day, and now this is the period that we're looking at. So I'm not sure how that, you know, necessarily affects the analysis here. But like I said, if it turns out that the court did that improperly and that 2 months actually applies to the 5 months that he, you know, imposed, and I suppose the court could simply modify that portion as it does in other cases. My concern there, of course, is that he may get double credit for that period. And I think, you know, if we're dealing with that kind of ambiguity, because I kind of struggled with whether I should suggest that this case should be remanded for resentencing because of that prop that says that once the sentence, you know, a sentence validly imposed becomes or takes effect from the time it's pronounced. It's like, well, the sentence that was imposed in this case was valid. It was within the time period. There's no dispute there. But the credit issue could potentially affect what the court intended to do. You know, who bears the risk of that mistake? I guess that's what it boils down to.
What's the best practice here? Revoke and sentence at the same time?
Well, I mean, that makes it tidy. Yeah, I mean, it makes it cleaner. It's just the courts will have to be clearer about what. I think this case is a little bit weird, too, because he was revoked. He was sentenced by two different judges in these two different cases who imposed the two different terms of supervised release. And then for some reason, Judge Livingston, who I believe is retired, came back into the picture. He's the one that actually revoked the defendant and remanded him into custody. And then when he came on for sentencing, he was back before Judge Young because I believe Judge Luther had retired by that time. So
was he serving both post-release supervisions at the same time, commencing October 10, 2018?
Well,
And is that contradictory to the original sentence and the statute that says you can't do that?
It is. I mean, I think it's clear. It's clear that assault by a confined person, by statute, or by operation of law, is required to run consecutively. But Judge Luther also ran it consecutively. She handled it the way she was supposed to.
She did correctly. Originally, the sentence says it's to be served consecutive to any other sentence. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, she did. And just for the court's edification, that statute actually does apply because he did commit all of those other sentences or those other crimes first, and he was sentenced on them first. So there's no question about whether there might have been, you know, where that statute applies. It does.
But in reality, when he's released from custody, at least allegedly by the motion to revoke the post-release supervision, it says that they both started post-release supervision October 10, 2018.
Well, that's how it was treated.
What impact does that have on our analysis?
Well, my point is if you take that sentence as a whole, we say, okay, not only does the incarceration have to run consecutively, but also the term of supervised release, it effectively moots the second issue. Because if he was only serving one term of supervised release, he can't be revoked on two, he can't be sentenced on two, the other sentence is void, and that part of it is over. I don't know exactly because, you know, the statute, the legislature didn't really tell us how we're supposed to deal with multiple terms of supervised release.
Putting aside the mandatory consecutive, yeah, if you have just a discretionary consecutive, doesn't the way the post-release supervision statute work is they serve the consecutive imprisonments and then serve post-release supervision all at once? Isn't that the scheme of the post-release supervision statute?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've read those statutes a few times, and I never took that away. That's always been the question for me, is, well, do they run concurrently or consecutively? I mean, because we have, you know, they speak in terms of a single term, but clearly the way the other statutes are written, the legislature intended that when you have a Class 4, a Class 3, or 3A, the court is required to impose a term of supervised release. And there's also a provision in 29-2204.02 that says if the court fails to impose that term, then by operation of law, it becomes a minimum by law. Now, if you look at the sentencing issue that Judge Young issued in this case, he was sentenced on three Class 4 felonies, but the court only imposed one supervised release term for 12 months. Now, technically, he should have gotten 12, 9, and 9, and he could have been revoked on all three of those, plus the other one that, you know, Judge Luther imposed, assuming that those were running at the same time. But I haven't read those statutes to mean that they have to run concurrently. So I was like, well, do you treat these sentences as a unitary whole? And if you impose them consecutively, that applies to the that applies first to the terms of imprisonment, and then with the supervised release has to run concurrent or consecutively as well. Or because it's a split sentence and we treat the two halves differently, can you run the incarceration consecutively and then run the terms of supervised release concurrently? Now, if you look at the federal statutes and the way they handle it, the federal or the Congress has actually provided for that contingency. What happens is if you have a defendant who's convicted on two felonies and the court imposes incarceration on both of those felonies and followed by a term of supervised release, by statute, the court has the discretion to run the incarceration concurrently or consecutively, but the two terms of supervised release are required to run concurrently. However, if the defendant, while serving two terms, violates, gets revoked, the court has the authority to sentence him to imprisonment on both of those and then to run them either consecutively or concurrently, notwithstanding the fact that the original terms were run concurrently. Because they say that ordinary, since Congress has not specifically dealt with that scenario, they just go back to the default provisions on ordinary sentencing principles, which I think are the ones that would apply here. The court has the discretion. Assuming he was serving two terms, he could be revoked on both, court could sentence him on both, and he could get consecutive sentences.
Which he did in this case.
Which he did in this case. I don't see anything wrong with that.
This specific order says that 5 months on each case to be served consecutive to each other.
Exactly. Exactly.
And nothing in the statute prohibits that?
No. No, I don't think so, because they haven't provided for it. I mean, you know, I think it's written in the singular, at least 2268. It just says if you're serving a term of supervised release, but it doesn't say, well, what happens when you have multiple terms? And if there's a provision that you're referring to that I have missed, I apologize. I just have never read. I've been through those statutes a couple of times recently because I've had some issues in a couple of cases.
In fact, in State v. Roberts, isn't that what happened? Defendants sentenced to a term of incarceration in two different counties, post-release supervision in two different counties, serves his incarceration, serves post-release supervision in one county, gets released from that, starts serving post-release supervision in another county, gets revoked on that one.
I think so. Was that the one that Nate had? Was that Nate Liss's case?
Yeah, I think so.
And that was more recently. Was that the one that was dismissed because it was moot? Or
yes.
The court determined that it was moot? Yeah, I believe right. That's what happened in that case. But, you know, I'm not sure. And I think it's always created a bit of a problem because I think district courts, at least as it appears from this case and perhaps others, that there's some confusion as to how that works. If you can run those terms of supervised release, and I can see some benefit to doing that, because if you have somebody who's convicted of maybe three or four Class 3s or Class 3As, maybe you want to send a little stronger message on the incarceration, but you don't want to sentence that person to an extraordinarily long term of supervised release because you don't think it's going to serve that purpose. You know, you don't want to give somebody, you know, 10 years in prison and then they have to follow it up with 3 or 4 years of supervised release. And so there could be some benefit to treating those two portions separately, but I'm not aware of any statutory provision that allows
you
to do that.
So stepping back, what is our task to try and make sense of the statute as written as compared to the federal statute, which provides for the multiple situation?
Well, yeah, you're in a worse position.
We're asking for help.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, the federal law is not binding on you, of course, but it's nice when they provide for those kinds of contingencies. But even there's a gap. Like I said, you know, they've said, look, they don't tell us what happens when those concurrent terms get revoked, and they just fall back on the ordinary
principles.
You can go,
right.
Yeah, consecutive or concurrent, and that happened.
Right.
And there have been cases where someone has gotten consecutive terms on concurrent releases, consecutive terms of post or imprisonment, and
right.
They have exceeded the term of incarceration, like the original term.
Right.
And courts have upheld those against challenge. So I think those apply, but like I said, I don't think we have.
What is the state's response to Mr. Piccolo's suggestion in the case of criminal statutes that are unclear or ambiguous that we would be inclined to leniency?
Well, I'm not sure where the ambiguity is here. I mean, I think, you know, I
is it just a gap, just some
omission.
Lacuna? There's just no provision for multiples?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think that's ambiguous. I just think that they haven't provided for it. I mean, this works well when you have one term followed by one term of imprisonment followed by one term of supervised release, but it gets far more complicated in the Roberts scenario when you've got somebody who has offended in multiple counties or when you have somebody who has multiple convictions and multiple terms of supervised release. It's like, well, then how do we treat these? And I'm not sure that our statutes necessarily provide the answer, so unfortunately that task falls to you, or maybe we need a legislative fix on some of these things. But That's my position, is I think that they probably ran consecutive. He was probably only serving the one term. The second sentence is void, which would move the second issue. But even if it doesn't, the court correctly served or sentenced him to 2 5-month terms, and that should be upheld. So, sorry, I don't have any more answers for you than that. But if there are no further questions, I'm sorry, I've gone well over my time. I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 46 seconds.
46 seconds, Mr. Pickle.
I just to respond a little bit, if I can. I think the practice in Nebraska is that at time of sentencing, you're supposed to state the amount of time that a person has served since State versus Groff, a long, long time ago. I agree with the court's and the state's suggestion that the statutes are not very clear as to what to do in many of the post-release supervision aspects. Again, I would just refer that I think if there's some sort of unclarity, the defendant, obviously, or Mr. Galvin would get the benefit of any doubt. With that, I don't have anything else, and I'll submit.
Mr. Pickle, what statutory authority do you have to say they could not, the court could not order the 2 post-release supervision revocation sentencings consecutive?
I think they can. Okay. In my brief, the only limit is the remaining term of post-release supervision. So you can fashion a sentence, but as long as it doesn't go beyond the remaining term of post-release supervision.
Okay.
So I agree. You can do it consecutive, but again, that's the limit. That's the statutory limit.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Yedlicka.